Hi, Kelly.
Hello.
Hi, I'm Carl Smith, and I'm an assistant professor at University of North Carolina School of Government and a blogger at modelbehavior.com, and I'm here with Kelly Evans.
Yes, hi. This is the first time I've done this. Bear with me. I write the ahead of the tape column for the Wall Street Journal. I also contribute to Heard on the Street and do a few other things as well.
Okay, so we're here, we're going to talk about Grease number one. I think that's probably like the biggest issue today. If we get past that, maybe we'll talk a little bit about NGP targeting, which is a big thing in the blogosphere now, and I think it's made it out to the mainstream press. And maybe a little bit about the U.S. economic situation. And I know, Kelly, you have some thesis about permanent decline in the United States, so we can talk about that if we get to it.
Yeah,
But
that's probably putting it a little bit strongly, but I have my concerns, so.
So anyway, so the Greece situation, this is something that you're following. So why don't you see if you can get us like up to speed on what's going on since you're the
Yeah,
reporter here.
sure. There are, I think, a couple of different angles here to follow. I think the most relevant one, aside from kind of the politics within Greece, which is important, obviously, but really there are a lot of broader things happening that investors, what's really interesting for me is that investors, the sources that I speak with for months now, have kind of been saying, look, the European Union, they'll get its act together, they'll figure out this Greece thing, stop asking us all these questions about the existentials kind of crisis or future of the European project. Lo and behold, here we are, where this week, very significantly, we've had European leaders suddenly debating the future of this monetary union. And I think one thing that's really important to keep in mind here is that obviously this isn't just a situation, quote unquote, about Greece. Greece is a tiny country. It's a very small part of the EU. It's not its direct influence that is so critical so much as what happens with Greece is very telling about the future of what happens with the euro. As we've seen all the difficulty just trying to address this situation, you can only imagine what it would look like if suddenly we had to deal with an Italy in a similar situation. So there are a couple of ways this directly affects the US. Obviously, anytime there's a recession, which it's very clear the EU is heading into, it affects trade directly. There are other direct channels, but there's also indirect channels. Bank lending, obviously, very important. So all of these different ways this crisis is going to affect the US. And unfortunately, European leaders have not gotten their arms around the situation at all in the way that they had envisioned just a few months ago. And that is what has precipitated everything from really the decline of MF Global to concerns about other firms and their exposures and raising a lot of questions again that really never were correctly addressed after the 2008 crisis about the shadow banking system, counterparty trust, and how the financial institution, the global financial system, really for all its complexity, is still very vulnerable to doubt and the kind of concerns that come when you see Italian bond yields, for example, continuing to surge despite all the efforts to show that this problem is somehow contained.
Okay, so there's a whole lot there. Why don't we go back? So the key problem, I think, if you ask most people, like, so what do they understand, is that Greece ran up a whole bunch of debt and they can't pay it off. Is that how would you
Yeah, I
is that
would
your
say
take?
there the problem with Greece is not just that they were in some ways profligate, but also that they were that the system it wasn't just a question of, oh, growth is gone and now suddenly we have debts we can't service. It is, the entire structure of this state is not sustainable. So that is one difference with some of the other countries in Greece where they weren't necessarily, they don't necessarily need entirely new ways of bringing people into the tax code and doing that kind of thing. They really just need growth and the ability to kind of, use that to allow some austerity and to service some of these debts. So yes, there are two problems. One, Greece borrowed too much. Two, Greece is structurally set up in a way that is not sustainable.
Okay, so why is this gonna tear apart the euro though?
It shouldn't. That's what people had been saying, which is that look, Greece is a small country, and we will be able to do things with, for example, the European Central Bank, an agreement with European leaders on other programs, including support from international programs like the IMF, to fund the country to make sure that it can meet its debts for the next couple of years while it puts all these structural adjustments in place. The reason why it wanted to make sure it can meet its debts, of course, is that you know, and this is really the rub, this whole question boils down to investors versus taxpayers, and Greece is kind of a microcosm of that. The reason why they put so much emphasis on meeting the obligations of investors, even at the expense of sort of current people in Greece or the taxpayer system, is because if Greece were to default on its debts, now it's sort of the pebble in the rippling effect throughout the pool here. Greece can't meet its debts. People who have exposure, not just directly to Greek bonds, because the amount here isn't overwhelming, but exposure to banks that may have exposure to Greek bonds. So it's Greek. Whatever starts in Greece sort of then emanates throughout the rest of the European system as people try and figure out, without very good clarity, especially on a day-to-day basis, who's holding the bonds, you know, where the financial system will, as a result of losses, if they have to write down some of the value of this debt, wind up being undercapitalized. And once it's undercapitalized, the risk, of course, is that it's not just one or two institutions, but that as people demand more collateral or just lose a little bit of faith in who may or may not have exposures, that the entire system becomes insolvent. That's the real worry here, and that's why it's sort of we have to keep Greece going so that we don't run into a situation where suddenly we've created a much larger problem. This was the very same consideration that happened around the U.S. financial system and exposure to mortgage debt in 2008, albeit at the time leverage ratios were much lower, capital was much lower. So there are important differences, but the systemic concerns are very similar.
Yeah, and I mean, at least, you know, what I've been telling people, you can see if this follows along with your saying, is this is very similar to the situation with Lehman, right?
Yeah.
So if Greece goes down, go ahead.
Yeah. I think the similarities, especially with 2008 and what happened with mortgage debt. So if you were to sort of boil these two situations down, in 2008, you had mortgage debt that was sort of the toxic security at the heart of the problem. No one was really sure who was exposed to it and how much. And there was this sense that if suddenly the value of that had to fall, then that meant the banking system largely could be rendered insolvent as a result of that. And of course, if you try to raise capital in that kind of situation or do the kinds of asset sales that you would need to bolster your capital levels, that then, as we know with asset prices, once they start to fall, once that selling happens, they continue to fall. It exacerbates the problem, and there's no real way to get out of that. And for example, Richard Koo, who's, you know, economist, who's done a lot of good work on these kinds of questions, has compared, has taken the situation, for example, of the rolling Latin American debt crisis in the 1980s, where Paul Volcker actually went to U.S. banks and said to them, you know, you will keep lending here. The answer is that you're not pulling back on these obligations. And basically by going in, by strong arming them and sort of ordering them to keep lending to maintain their exposure, avoided the kind of situation that we saw in the U.S. to some extent in 2008 and now potentially in Europe around this question of exposure to Greek debt and other debt. And you know, Carl, if this were just about Greek debt, it'd be one thing. But the problem is that we've seen Italian bond yields. I keep saying Italy, it's the third biggest government bond market in the world. When those yields keep rising, it means that it doesn't matter just what exposure people have to Greek debt or what that means to the system. Suddenly it means any European debt exposure, you know, what does that mean to the system? And people, the entire global financial system is much more exposed to all these various larger kinds of larger countries' debt than it is just to Greece.
Okay, so yeah, so that brings out an important point that I've made about Lehman since it happened, and I think it holds about Greece to an even larger extent, which is that this is, you know, in my mind, a failure of central banking, right? So that the role of the Federal Reserve, which is the central bank of the United States, and the European Central Bank, with Central Bank of Europe, one of their major roles is basically to prevent this type of domino effect from occurring. And they can do that in essentially the way that you describe with Paul Volcker. I mean, one, they can use, I mean, in economists we call that moral suasion, whatever, when you just say, look, you guys...
Is that a nicer way of saying moral hazard?
moral suasion is a nicer way of saying strong arm, right? So moral suasion is when you say, you know, it would be nice for the future of the global capitalist system if everybody could come to an understanding here. So you bring people in a room to do that. You know, so supposedly, I mean, I don't know the details of it, you're a reporter, maybe you do, after when long-term capital management fell apart, that Greenspan did that, essentially brought bankers into a room and said, look, it would be very nice for the future of the global capitalism if you found a way to to handle this without
Yeah.
without everyone panicking. Yeah. And
Goes back to
so you can
J.P.
do that.
Morgan and the Panic of 1907.
Yeah, so you can do that, which is, you know, which may be effective, just sort of, you know, arm twisting. Or the Federal Reserve has the ability to print money, and so they always have the ability to loan money to anyone who needs it. And so you have the opportunity there to essentially make the problem go away. With Lehman, I mean, I think maybe there's some deeper questions we can ask. I don't know if we want to go back that far, but certainly the European Central Bank easily has the power to lend Greece any money that it needs.
Well, wait,
right?
Just to be clear, are you suggesting that if the central banks are more aggressive here, that they'd be able to make this problem go away? Because I think I would take issue with that.
Yeah, that's my essential case, that the problem could go away. More or less, yes, that if to be really specific, the European Central Bank could simply say that Greek bonds will trade at 2%, and that's the end of the story. And then essentially the medium term problem would just go away. So the problem that maybe there would be a default would just disappear. And I think that there's not that big of a long term problem. So you can tell me how you feel about that.
Well, so you know, I guess in order to get, this is what the ECB would love to do, right? They would love to basically say Greece is borrowing at 2%. Italy, you can borrow at 4%. You know, everyone. The whole point, obviously, is to try and get everyone these low borrowing costs so that they can then hopefully avoid the kinds of, you know, prohibitive debt payments that will only make their recessions and their economies even worse, et cetera, and sort of fuel investor concern. Now, the problem is, I mean, especially for the European Central Bank, so the U.S. can do this, basically. I mean, the Federal Reserve can print money, or, you know, whatever euphemism you want to use, can basically try and keep interest rates low or particularly low so long as there are other factors, i.e. inflation's not a concern and that's not going to sort of like fuel a run-up in long-term interest rates and that kind of thing. It can do this because it has the balance sheet to do this. The problem with the European Central Bank right now is that it's not in a position, or at least not actively in a position, to get Greek borrowing costs down to that level. So that basically the cost of trying to take...
Why?
Well, the cost of trying to take Greek... I mean, Greece is one thing. It's pretty small, so they could effectively do this. The problem is doing it not just for Greece, but for other nations as their borrowing costs start to rise. So especially, I mean, I think that there's a certain level of, you know, about 4.5 basis points, for example, on Italian debt relative to German debt, where they'd love to be able to cap that level. It's unclear, I think, depending on sort of who's in charge of the ECB or whatever, but it's unclear how you can just say, you know, forever, you know, starting now, we're not letting the cost of this rise. We're going to buy all of these bonds, blah, 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 blah. You know, that do they unilaterally have the capability to do that? I don't
yes.
see how that's possible.
so they have, so to quote the current Federal Reserve chairman, they have a technology called the printing press, which allows them to produce money at virtually zero cost, right? And so the way you do this is you say, if Greek bonds rise above 2%, we will buy them, right? And we will keep buying them until the yields fall below 2%. And where are we going to get the money from? We're going to print it. And that's where we're going to get the money from. And we're just going to keep doing this until it's done. Now, I mean, one of the arguments that, you know, economists like myself make is that, in fact, you don't even actually have to do this. You don't even actually have to print that much money in most cases. You just have to tell people that you intend to do this, right? And then, the market rate will just go to 2% because you can't fight the central bank. You can't, if the central bank chooses a price for a debt instrument, because they always have more money than you, if you attempt to buy or sell at a different price, they will always create losses for you. And so then there's no point to trading in any other zone, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the only way that you would have some sort of a problem is if Greece, in fact, did not pay, did not service its debt, and then that would affect sort of the, I mean, to get really complicated, so that would affect the capital balance of the European Central Bank and other stuff like that. And maybe that's an issue, maybe it's not. But this is my argument, and maybe you agree or not, is that if the borrowing costs were not a problem, then Greece really wouldn't have that much of a problem, right? I mean, you seem to be saying the opposite before. So what's your defense of that?
I guess what this boils down to, and I think maybe more of the kind of moral concern here, is that you know, there's a way here to kind of fix the problem, to sort of make this problem go away. But is that equivalent to actually making the problem go away? So, you know, you could cap, you know, in a perfect world, Greek bond yields at 2%, Italian bond yields at 4%, or whatever. You know, unfortunately, that then kind of takes away the market signals that these countries do have fundamental problems. So, you know, if you take the example of Greece or Italy or whatever, you know, if ultimately their situations are not brought into a more sustainable kind of long-term position, you know, so if there's no stick there to kind of drive, you know, more productive societies or broaden the tax base or whatever, how is that a good thing?
Well, first, it's a good thing because monetary collapse is a big, big deal, right? So, I mean, if we look at the worst things that have happened in the world, economically speaking, they were monetary collapses. So the Great Depression in the United States, the Long Depression in Germany in the 1870s, the current global financial crisis right now, these are probably the worst things that have ever happened to the global economy. And they were all monetary collapses. They were all banking collapses, right? So one of the arguments I make, I made this, I think, with Megan and some other people, it's not, I mean, what exactly are you afraid of here, right? So, I mean, the worst thing that could happen is about to happen. And we just went through one of the worst things that could happen, and you're thinking about letting it happen again. So what are you attempting to prevent? I mean, you're saying, well, if we don't allow the worst thing in the world to happen, something else will happen. I mean, this is the worst thing in the world. And so that would be my immediate response to not doing it. The second thing is I just don't think that long term it's that severe of a moral hazard issue. So even in Greece, I think, you know, I was just looking at the IMF numbers earlier today because I knew we were going to talk about it. Their primary budget deficit, so that's basically how much money do they spend versus how much money they take in, is like 3% of GDP. So they're spending 3% of GDP more than they're taking in. That's not good, but that's not horrible. And at least according to the IMF, on the path that they're on, they're going to achieve what we call primary balance in 2012, 2013, if everything was okay. And so
those are kind of the big main.
Yeah, but I mean, but your alternative is potential global financial crisis, right? And so why is global financial crisis a preferable thing?
No, I agree, I think what concerns me here, and this is kind of reminiscent of the NGDP thing, which we can get into in a second, but which is to say,
sure,
you know, there is a more desirable outcome right now. Clearly, that is to you know, from Greece's point of view, to get it very low borrowing costs so that, you know, it's not plunged into this sort of inexorable recession situation. But then there's
right,
the question.
That would not be a good outcome.
Yeah. Then there's the question, though, of, well, wait a minute. What is the unsustainability of the situation actually telling us? It's maybe telling us that Greece doesn't belong in, say, a European monetary union, that it's not ultimately in its favor because it can't devalue against these countries, that its business cycle is completely out of sync, that it has other issues, blah, blah, blah. If you basically keep it in, give it low borrowing costs, you are never reckoning with this question, which so you keep them in there in order to kind of prevent this problem now without ever actually addressing what may be the real problem here.
Yeah, but my argument is if you address problems or you don't address problems, right? So there's an issue about whether or not Greece should even be in the euro. There's an issue about whether or not the European Central Bank is a competent organization that ought to continue to exist. So, I mean, there are lots of questions about that. But we have to talk about and address those. And we have to say, all right, maybe Greece should make an exit or whatever. It's not clear to me the way you should make an exit is by tearing down the entire global financial system, right? But that's what
of
you
course.
Should do.
Yeah,
say,
no,
right,
no,
right.
Of course. But how do we, if we don't, if I agree, and it's funny, I sort of find myself arguing the opposite of what I actually think, you know, I feel like I'm playing devil's advocate mm-hmm. a little bit here, but I do, I mean, look, if we know that sort of to eject Greece in this sort of messy, horrible way, and then, you know, have these sort of concerns spreading to larger nations, if we know the impact that that's likely to have on the global financial system and we can avoid that for now, that's great. But I guess what I worry about is that everyone goes, well, great, problem solved, we can move on. And it's like, well, no, you know, we staved this off. We got this situation where we were able to kind of avoid the worst outcome. But then as you know, as I know well, people do tend to kind of just say, well, crisis averted and move on and not go, well, wait a minute, this was a major flaw. This is a fundamental flaw. And so when you're in a situation where all of these questions about major fundamental flaws within the European Monetary Union and the EU set up the way they are right now without fiscal integration, et cetera, are uh-huh. really important, really big questions. You know, if you basically just go, well, hey, everyone, we'll get back to these, you know, borrowing costs where we can at least put this question off the table for now. Will you ever reckon really with the situation that you've created and with the problems that it implies? I mean, look, Germany has benefited enormously from having the undervalued EU currency over the last decade.
Right.
Basically, it because you cannot have deflation in countries like Spain or Ireland or Italy or whatever. Ireland's a bad example because of that already happening to some degree there. But in some of these more peripheral countries with high debt loads and low growth, et cetera, if ultimately the only way out here for the EU is inflation in Germany, and yet we know the history of inflation in Germany, it's extremely undesirable among the people there. So, you know, there are, it's not
right.
to
and
say it, that these things are going to go away because we're suddenly able to allow, you know, lower borrowing costs in the near term for, say, a Greece.
Right. I mean, this is my basic point, which is that, you know, so if people read what I want, the German central bankers love to go on this morality carousel where everybody needs to suffer and have the economy destroyed so that they can avoid 3% inflation. But, you know, and it's, oh, about how, you know, you shouldn't have gotten yourself in this position in the first place. When I think the goal of central banking is akin to the goal of a fire department to when everything starts burning down to put out the fire. And the German sort of attitude towards it was, well, you know, you shouldn't have been playing with matches, and so we'll just let your house burn down. And that's a problem, and that's part of, I think, why the European Central Bank is one of the most incompetent organizations on the planet. But you know, that's a problem that has to be dealt with. I would prefer to say, well, look, let's have the best possible outcome we can have now. Let's attempt to either deal with or dismantle this organization. I don't think that anybody at a policy level is walking away from this saying, you know, this proves the fundamental stability of the European project, right? I mean, everyone was scared. Everyone thinks this is a bad idea. And if we're going to deal with it in a constructive way, then we should deal with it in a constructive way by making the case that we should stop doing this. And if you're not going to stop doing this, then the best thing you should do is prevent as much fire as you can, prevent as much human suffering as you can. And if it gets to the point where you can't prevent any more human suffering, then that's fine. But there's no reason to say, let's have more human suffering now because we're afraid that there's some fundamental issue that will cause human suffering later. I mean, that to me is just a radically bad idea. I see people do it all the time, but it's just a horrible way to run policy, is my opinion. But
well, and I mean,
anyway,
I think I just would add that with the you know, with what's happening in Europe right now, we've seen a real deterioration in a lot of economic fundamentals across the Eurozone, not surprisingly, over the last couple of quarters, and it really does sort of say, you know, here we've tried austerity. It's clearly not going to work. So the real question is, okay, well, what is going to work? Ultimately, is this, and this is where it gets to this really interesting question about Germany's role and this question of a transfer union and how far is Germany willing to go here to keep the union intact. And this is where I think watching attitudes of German people are going to be extremely important, because European leaders know there's not really a way. They're stuck in the burning building together. And there is a sense that Germany, after having benefited for many years under this situation, And by the way, having lower consumption rates, and maybe some say that it should, et cetera, it's now time for it to sort of step up to the plate and do its part. And yet the German people sort of somewhat understandably, depending on their knowledge of the situation, are going, well, remind me again why I want to do this. So in any case, I guess we agree that, you know, that there is a way out here, at least a temporary way out. And I just remain really concerned that, you know, even if you're able to get lower borrowing rates for Greece or something like that, that same with some other fundamental problems that will ultimately just kind of make it worse, not better, long term. But perhaps we should leave it there on this issue at least.
Sure. If you want to. I mean, the sort of, you know, I think of this as hawk dove issue about whether or not you should just kick cans down the road. I don't know how much of my stuff you read, but I mean, I have this long standing thesis on that kicking cans down the road is the essence of success. This story, you know, as I tell to my students, the story only has one ending, right? I mean, everybody dies. So, I mean, it's not going to go well. I mean, our individual lives, the lives of our family, even the human project, it's not going to go well. We are not forever. The earth is not forever. Humanity is not forever. None of these things are forever. They're all going to end badly. There's no question about that. The question is what happens in the meantime.
Wait a minute. This sounds to me like justification for saying, like, if this sounds really justification for a hedonistic existence.
Well, I mean, I'm fairly utilitarian, so I mean that's not that far off. But I mean, you have a path, right? So some things are going to happen, and some things like so.
I'm gonna have to pull out my Seneca or something here on you.
No, pull out whatever you want, because I mean, I think there are deep philosophical issues at work. I mean, one of the things that I think is important, you know, we'll go into more economic stuff too, but one of the things that's important is to think about why some of the organizations fail. I think why the ECB fails, why we have some of the disagreement and stuff we do in Congress, and a lot of people point to, you know, oh, there's special interests or this. I actually don't think those are that important. I think that people have different philosophies about, you know, what matters and what doesn't matter, and that some of them are wrong.
But I guess what I'm worried about is demonstrably wrong. Look, I think we know how bad this kind of this uh-huh. whole question of morality can affect sort of economic policymaking and lead to bad outcomes and that kind of thing. But I mean, to me, I don't see how a situation where you say, look, this is all going to end badly, so enjoy it while you can. I mean, that almost to me is like the total opposite of what a society should really be all about. I mean, I think it should be about sort of making sound decisions with like the resources that you have now and saying, you know, there are choices I could make now, there are things I could consume now or whatever, but, you know, I'm not going to do that for the best of society long term, because I have enough respect or care for sort of the human question to do things that kind of minimize harm long term. And I think what you are saying to me sounds like the opposite, which is, well, there is going to be harm long term, so I might as well enjoy this while I have it. And I sort of shudder at that notion.
Yeah, I mean, I think that see how much time we got. Yeah, so, you know, my point is that it's the delusion that the end, that things are going to end well, or that this is not, you know, so
I thought I was supposed to be the one who was negative on, like, you know, the our future here. And
see, this is the thing. So this is you know, I talk a lot to people about this. This is why, like, you know, complete nihilism can lead you to be like really, really happy about things. But I can understand why denialism or whatever about, like, sort of the future and that everything is going to end badly is like appealing to people. But you're going to waste and misunderstand, like, what you should do, because your question is not sort of like what is the ultimately responsible thing or anything like that. Your question is what's the best path, right? So we're on a journey. This journey is going to come to an end. We know that now, right? I mean, for each of us as individuals, it's going to come to an end not that long from now. for our families a little bit further, for humanity, hopefully much, much longer, although, you know, there are reasons to think that that might not be true.
But what you're saying to me sounds like it brings forward the question of how long humanity can perpetuate.
Well, okay, so, I mean, if you are only thinking about, well, let's just push everything, or, you know, let's have, what's the word people love? Sustainability, right? You know, so everything for sustainability, then that's a mistake, because our society is fundamentally not sustainable. Life itself is fundamentally not sustainable. That's not what's going to happen. We're not going to be sustained, right? So we have to think about this as an extraction problem. We have to think about this as, you know, they're going to be, you know, we're going to live, our children are going to live, the people we care about are going to live, you know, for some period of time. And how do we make them have the best lives that they can possibly have, right? But this is not going to continue indefinitely. It's not going to be sustainable indefinitely. That's not what's going to happen. That's not the game that we're playing. And so, we shouldn't approach it that way. And I know that's probably a little bit too deep for actually dealing with the sort of European banking crisis. But I mean, I do think that people sometimes get caught up in the issue of sustainability. When I say, well, the real issue is, I mean, they're people, they're going to have lives. Those lives are either going to be filled with like misery or not, or more or less misery, really, you know, and we should try to have less, right? So, I mean, we should try to have less for the people of Greece today. We should probably try to have less for the people of Greece tomorrow. We should try to have less for humanity as we go forward. And if we do that, and if we have a path that do that, then we've done well. We've done the best thing that we can do for society.
Right. Yeah. Right. No, I would agree with, I know I would agree with that, yeah. But that's why I don't, I mean, if we're talking, I think it is a question of how, you know, if we're talking about ultimately, you know, an unsustainable situation or whatever, but you can have, you know, society that extends 5 or 10 generations and not just 3 by sort of minimizing your usage of resources or sort of doing things in a more wise and prudent way now in order to sort of maximize that long-term benefit, then, you know, I mean, that to me, what you just said seems to me to imply that is what we should do. But then earlier, I felt like you were saying that isn't what we should do.
No, that is what we should do. But that's a question that we actually have to answer. Right. So, I mean, that's why I sometimes put that to people. So you're saying, OK, the situation in Greece may not be sustainable or other things if we get into like, you know, global warming or other issues. They're not sustainable. Right. So, but that alone is not the case. The case has to be that. If we do X, we can make it for, you know, as far as the eye, 20 generations. If we do Y, we'll only make it 3 generations. And 20 is better than 3. And if you can make that case to me, then you have something. But simply saying that, well, somewhere down the road, I don't know when.
Well, let's end this quickly on Greece. So if the question is we can do something for Greece that makes it better for Greece 20 generations from now, or that ensures that there is a Greece 20 generations from now or whatever, versus, you know, policies that would be, you know, much more, you know, harmful or sort of, you know, hurt that question of perpetuity, you know, then I think we both agree that, and obviously the Greeks would agree that you choose those policies to sort of ensure their sort of long-term viability. Now, I think where we disagree is that you think the way to do that is to sort of help rectify their current economic malaise as quickly as possible. And I worry that if we do that, we're in fact still hastening a decline here because they're left in an ultimately unsustainable, not helpful long-term position, which is not being addressed in any way, shape, or form.
Okay. I can agree with that.
Agree to disagree. Great. Yeah, great.
Well, no. You know, there's no agreeing to disagree. We're agreeing to agree. But yeah. Anyway, so. But go ahead. Go ahead. You want to talk about some other stuff. I'm sorry.
Well, let's just pivot from there real quick. And I just want to ask this too. This question of NGDP, which is nominal gross domestic product. You can explain it to the layperson, perhaps, if you rather. But I wonder, do you think the viability of this as a policy issue or something is for the Federal Reserve to target has been, do you think its case has been helped or hurt by all the publicity and attention that it's suddenly gotten over the past month or so?
So helped. I mean, would be my initial response. I mean, we can think through it a little bit more because I actually haven't thought a lot about that question. But for the folks out there, so everybody has probably heard of GDP or gross domestic product, which is how we measure, you know, the size of various economies. So GDP for the U.S. is what you mostly hear about. When we try to calculate GDP, what we want to do is look at the value of everything in the U.S. economy that's been created after accounting for inflation, right? So if the prices of stuff goes up, you don't want to necessarily say that more value has been created because it's just that people are paying more for it. Nominal GDP sort of removes that distinction. So we're actually just looking at what is the total amount that people are paying for stuff. So you can alternative, you can say either what's the total amount of spending in the economy, which I think is what's natural for a lot of people, or you can say what's the total amount of income in the economy, which is how lots of folks like to say it because it sounds better, but in a closed economy, those two things have to be the same, right? So someone's spending is someone else's income, so they're the same thing. But that's in GDP. And so Scott Sumner has pretty much devoted his blog to pushing the idea that what our central bank, what the Federal Reserve should do is target in GDP. And so what it means is that basically they should ensure that in GDP grows every year at about 5% per year. And you can talk about in a minute how they might ensure that that happens, but that's his argument they should do. And they shouldn't worry about what part of that is inflation or what part of that is real growth. But they just should worry about the fact that spending in the economy grows by 5% a year, or put it another way, that people's incomes in the economy grow by 5% a year. And so, but you had a question about whether or not it was helped or hurt, right?
Do you want to talk more about that? Before you, maybe we can save that for the sort of last question.
Okay.
There are so Goldman Sachs, which sort of sparked the piece that I did on this, because it was a sign that this really was getting traction, not just within the academic community and sort of the blog world, which was clear, but also suddenly popping up, you know, on Wall Street and maybe mm-hmm. making its way to sort of the thinking at the Fed, which
people
of course
quote,
we know
unquote, matter.
Yeah. So the approach, though, you mentioned targeting, say, a 5% growth rate a year. The approach that Goldman used was to say, in fact, we should target a level, that level being the level and GDP would have hit in a couple years' time, for example, or where we should be now if we hadn't had the recession. What do you think is sort of the consensus, or maybe what would Scott or yourself favor in terms of rate versus level targeting?
Oh, level. I don't know how far out of people's depth I'm going to get here, but basically you can say this. So you could either just say we're going to try to make total spending in the economy be 5% higher than what it was last year. Or you can say, look, just based on extrapolation, if this recession had never happened, I think I did the numbers yesterday, total spending in the U.S. economy would be $19.5 trillion, right? So we just need to devote ourselves to getting back up to $19.5 trillion and then 5% every year from that. So we need to, like, basically make up for the fact that spending has grown so slowly since 2007.
But wait a minute.
Yeah.
I feel like you have to choose one or the other, which is a level or a target. And this is part of my issue with this whole thing. But if you say we're going to target a level, i.e. a size of the economy, you know, and you get to a certain place, then doesn't the question then become how do we get to the same place, you know, next year or the year after? I would think. And this, again, is an issue that I had raised that I'm still unclear as to whether there's a problem with this assumption. But I would think that this nominal, even nominal, gross domestic product growth rate is going to slow over time simply because of slower population growth, slower labor force growth, et cetera, so that instead of having, say, just this 5% a year target, the point of a level is to kind of say, you know, we close the initial gap, and then it's a matter of determining – how quickly, what is potential nominal GDP growth imply for what it's going to be at the end of, say, next year, end of the following year, or end of this quarter, or whatever?
Yeah, I mean that's kind of a that's kind of technical, and I think over what do I want to say? It's not as big a issue as it might seem. So what I think the standard approach would be is to say get back to the level that you're on, right? And then just project out a level into the future that's every year 5% higher than it was the year
Are
before.
you just speaking
And
hypothetically, or is this actually you wouldn't just do that?
why not?
I mean, how could you? Part of my problem with this whole thing is to sort of say, because of past growth rates, notwithstanding anything that sort of has happened within the economy, but just to say we're going to project that forward as a 5% growth rate, period. I don't understand what the basis is for that.
Okay, so the basis is essentially this, is that 5% was a decent level during the Great Moderation, right?
Right, but we know a lot
It
of things about the
produces.
Great Moderation that suggest the Great Moderation maybe isn't a great name for it.
Well, we can talk about that, but because I know you have strong opinions about that. But the key is that it doesn't matter that much what number you pick or what like rate you pick. You just pick some rate. And so we were doing 5% for a while. It seemed to be working. Let's go back to 5%. Your essential argument is that, well, maybe sort of the fundamentals of the economy will slow down. Maybe population growth
Well,
will
and part
slow
of my
down.
argument is that I'm not
Maybe.
sure 5% a year was working, or that we should assume that there's going to be sort of smooth increases in nominal GDP growth, from here to infinity. Not that that is necessarily the assumption, but it seems to be the assumption, at least for right now, that the economy should have kept growing at the pace it was growing, should keep growing at that kind of pace, and, period, end of sentence. And I just feel like that misses a lot of, I mean, just this question of how sustainable, if you had taken the growth trajectory from, say, the mid-80s forward to now, would you be on a somewhat lower path? Would that gap be as large as it seems based on just projecting straight up out of 2007 levels as if that were totally sustainable in the first place, and as if to assume that, the recession was kind of this exogenous event that shouldn't have happened?
So there are a couple of things there. So basically the answer to your first question is more or less yes. So I had this, post up, maybe someone can find it. Look at the deviation from NGDP growth from about 1988 on to now, and up until the Great Recession, it was never off the level, off the path. So not per year, but how far off the path we were. We were never more than about 2% off the path. Sometimes we were above, sometimes we were
Were
below,
those
but
based
for the
on
most part,
projections from, say, 19? So were you taking NGDP projections from 1988?
Yeah, so I mean, well, we have, yeah, I mean, we don't need projections, and we have the actual numbers,
No,
but
but
yeah, I
that's a
mean,
very
so
different
we,
thing. I think that's a very,
what do you mean?
because all that matters is what the projections are going forward relative to the reality. So you can't just take the reality and say, well, we have the reality, so we just use that as a path, because I think the reality relative to what projections would suggest that path would be in 1988 would be extremely important.
Okay, so I'm not exactly sure what you're getting at, but maybe this will help clear us up. Let's say that real growth was slower than in the past, right? So let's say that in the past, the U.S. economy has had real growth in the 3% range, and that because of some demographic factors or other factors, that slows to 2%, right? But we stay with this nominal GDP growth path of 5% a year. Then that just means that inflation is now 3% instead of 2%. So you've just basically increased the level of inflation in the economy. That's all that happens. I mean, like, and I mean that would be the result. I mean, even if the economy ground to a halt and was just there was no real growth at all, then you would just have an economy with 5% inflation from here on into the future. And so for that reason, so long as the number is not huge, right? So long as the number is not, like 30% or something like that, then at least on that side of the equation, the worst thing that could happen is that you get 5% inflation, right? You get a 5% inflation rate, you know, projected out into the future. And if that did happen, I mean, it is possible for the to go back and say, well, we want a different path. 5% inflation is maybe too high. Though I don't think it's as, you know, it's super crazy bad, right? So we had about 4% inflation just after in the early 80s, just after, you know, Volcker brought down the inflation rate, and people thought that was kind of good. I mean, nobody was really crying about it. So I don't think it's the worst thing in the world. But that's really the only negative outcome there. Does that make, I mean, am I making sense? Am I sounding still crazy?
Well, I mean, I do have some concerns about this sort of assumption that oh, because we pick a 5% figure that the economy is going to hit that one way or the other, when I think the economy does what it does, and the dynamics between sort of growth and inflation are completely different than just the composition of this 5% figure that we're trying to assign to it. But go ahead.
Oh, well, I mean, I thought I was done. so no, I mean, you know, I'm not exactly sure what the question is. So, like, when we push out the Scott sort of core assumption, and there are ways that you might, you know, there are other ways that you might do this. So how you achieve this is kind of key. But I think that we're relatively all people in sort of nominal schools of economics, you know, Keynesians, monetarists, Scott, you know, they're planning to call them market monitors, would agree that sort of the level of the growth rate of nominal demand in the economy is more or less completely controllable by the Federal Reserve, right?
Yeah.
And the rate at which they're spending money, and so or rate at which they're printing money, and so as long as you can control nominal demand, you can make this happen. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I do.
That's our fundamental
assumption.
That's
right. And I mean, one question sort of within that, or one concern, I guess, is that, you know, it may not matter in a given year whether that inflation rate is 3% or 5% or whatever, but, you know, over time it makes a great deal of difference whether you're having a certain composition of real growth versus inflation. Because I think what concerns me a little bit is this idea that, you know, it doesn't matter because ultimately, you know, if nominal GDP growth grows at 5% a year over the next 5 years, and, you know, 4% of that is inflation, well, it doesn't matter because we'll still be working to bring down the unemployment rate. And I don't see, I thought sort of the folly of trying to use inflation to lower the unemployment rate had like long since been put to rest. And it's just like sort of surprises me to see it come back in saying it's not just a matter of sort of inflation rate fluctuations here or there, but that actually, even if this is overwhelmingly in an increase in inflation, that will still work to bring down the unemployment rate.
Yeah. So let me think of where I should start with that. So I think that it's generally accepted, you know, so, as Ben Bernanke said, it's something we know, that there's a trade-off between, inflation and unemployment, or short-run trade-off between inflation and unemployment. And that essentially boosting, you know, pushing out nominal demand, increasing the money supply, even if you know that's going to raise the rate of inflation, will bring down the unemployment rate. That's sort of the logic behind the Taylor rule, which I don't know how many people have heard of it, but essentially what it does is it tells the Federal Reserve how to balance between the concerns of inflation and unemployment. And when the Federal Reserve makes statements, sometimes they say, well, inflation is doing this, unemployment is doing this, and we have to balance between these two because there's generally a thought that there's a trade-off. The more you stimulate the economy, the more nominal demand you create, the more inflation you'll create, but the less unemployment you'll have, at least in the short term.
Right, and the short term, I think, being key.
Right, but I mean, once you go back to once you go back to full employment, then I mean, then that's that.
How would
you define
full you know, employment right now?
So my guess is that, you know, the full employment is somewhere around 5 to 6%.
Right, and what if it's 7?
Okay, then what if it's 7? Then you don't get as much real growth, and you get more inflation. I mean, that's the only thing that happens. I mean, like, let's say that we're pushing nominal, we're pushing
Right, but this question, I mean,
nominal
I think like
GDP
the
out.
implication is that it doesn't matter because ultimately the size of the economy is still the same. We've still achieved the goal, but I think that it's not the size, the ultimately the size of the economy that can be the only thing that matters, or else, you know, Zimbabwe or something would be, you know, the sort of beacon here for, you know, all maximizing GDP.
Right, but your goal is not to maximize NGDP, right? It's to grow it at some consistent level. That's why I said as long that's why the important thing, as long as your growth target is not that high. So that's why 5%. Yes, why 5%? Why not 10? And that's why not 10%? Why not 20%?
Right,
Why
but
not
what I mean is that
30%?
we're making a set of assumptions. So in order to get from here to where nominal GDP should be in these forecasts, suggests basically going pretty gung ho to try and get there. And my concern is, you know, between the inflation that may generate and just the assumptions about how big the economy right now should be, I think there's such a gray area that I don't understand how this is a preferable way to conduct monetary policy.
Yeah, I don't quite. Yeah, I mean, there's something that we're missing because I don't quite get what the gray area is. I
I
mean,
look the gray or what I mean by that is so, you know, we can take these CBO projections or as you say the you know pick a Goldman figure or anything else and say we should be at 19 trillion or 20 trillion. We just need to get there as quick as we can. But what I mean ultimately that there, I mean we're talking about pretty precise things here. I know that you know the whole question of whether you know GDP grows at a 4% or 6% rate may not seem to matter that much, but in fact, we are picking pretty determined levels for a size of an economy. And to me, I think there's just a danger of hubris there.
No, I mean, so I don't think that there is, and this I think is I don't know how philosophical I want to get since we're already at 50 minutes, but I'll just say my basic case on that, which is that that like ignorance is not abdication, and so like you just pick a number because you have to pick a number, right? But whatever you do is effectively picking a number. Any policy that you have is picking a number, and so. That you're aware that you're picking a number is no more, it has no more hubris attached to it than picking a number like unawares that you're doing it. I mean, the Fed action will produce some amount of nominal spending in the economy, right? And so we're saying, well, look, you know, if we stabilize this, we have reason to believe that we can not only bring down unemployment, but we'll have you know, stable expectations for people in the economy. They'll know what's going to happen the next year. They're going to have an idea of what sales are going to
Well, I
be.
think
They're going to be
stable
all these things that.
expectations might be a bit of a stretch relative to. Look, this isn't totally hypothetical. I mean, this has been discussed enough, and there's been enough sort of written about it that it's clear that this wouldn't go down well with everyone.
What do you mean? I mean,
In
that
NG,
would that not everybody would like it?
popularly speaking, yeah, a lot of people concerned about inflation that it generates, et cetera, and not even that it may boost inflation expectations so much that it just generates more kind of anti-Fed rhetoric and these kinds of things. So I didn't mean to interrupt, but go ahead.
Yeah, so we have to pick a number. Like there's no such thing as no monetary policy. You have some monetary policy, even if your policy is to keep things the way they are, and that has consequences. And so we're saying, well, look, I mean, this is our best guess at what a stable thing is. You know, so I pick a number, you know, 19.5 trillion. I said, well, let's go to 19.5 trillion. And then you say, and I think a lot of other people say, how do you know 19.5 trillion is exactly the right number? I don't know, but you're always picking a number. If you choose to do nothing, you're picking to stay at 14, right? Why is 14 the right number? I mean, I have reason to believe that unemployment is too high. You know, my basic reason for believing that is that I see lots of people who are unemployed and tell me that they don't want to be. I have reason to believe that inflation is relatively low. Right, or you know, especially core inflation as well is relatively low. It's because we measure the prices of lots of stuff. We have reason to believe that asset prices, you know, are low, and that's because we can see the trends on those things. And so, increasing back up to 19.5 trillion would alleviate or would put pressure to alleviate those things, and that's preferable to the situation that we are now. It's just not important whether or not it's the exact right number, because whatever you choose to do effectively chooses a number. It's better to choose something that might be right than something that's definitely wrong.
Right, I mean, which is fine. The problem there are just two things I would raise with that. The first is this is a question of some precision, because ultimately if you're targeting nominal GDP, i.e. you're conducting policy with a specific level in mind, it's extremely difficult, especially once you get close to that level. What happens if you go above that level, or you may go above? There has to be such a specific level in mind to actually, you know, do this in practice that I think that is relevant. But that aside, because your point is somewhat different, which is, you know, either you're picking 19 trillion or you're picking 15 trillion. I don't think that's true. I think you can say we would like a larger NGDP. You know, my concern may be that level is closer to 17 trillion than 19 trillion or whatever, meaning, you know, I may have some concern about what the projected forward path of the size of the economy is relative to where we came from, because that doesn't seem like it was, you know, necessarily a sustainable situation. And, you know, therefore, it's not that I'm picking 15 or 10 so much as just saying, you know, that level that you're shooting for may be unrealistically high, or the time period in which you're trying to achieve it may be unrealistically high. But, you know, those are just kind of, I mean, both of those sort of concerns, you know, the problem is the onus here, I think, is on how you would be much more specific and explicit about actually conducting monetary policy to say, this is the target, this is what we're aiming for. And, oh, by the way, I think there actually is a real credibility problem potentially, because if you got a friendly Federal Reserve, which doesn't necessarily look like you will, but a Federal Reserve that suddenly said, you know, Carl Smith, you're Fed chairman, and we are going to shoot for this $19 trillion figure. What happens if you can't or don't get there?
Okay, so that's an issue. I mean, on how you would, what the actual method of getting there is. And, you know, there are different approaches. And so, you know, I'll just talk a little bit about what I would do, because I'm fairly
You're ready to take your seat.
What'd you say?
So you're ready to take your
I'm ready at the Fed? No, yeah, I'm fairly traditionalist on how to do these sorts of things, at least compared to some other people. And I would say something like, you know, so my mock statement is the Open Market Committee, which is who determines interest rates, anticipates that economic conditions will warrant exceptionally low levels of the federal funds rate until the nominal size of the economy crosses 19.5 trillion. And essentially what you're saying there is that we think, you know, it's our best guess that the right thing to do right now is to keep interest rates very low. And how long are we going to do that? Well, our best guess is until the nominal size of the economy is larger than 19.5 trillion. And then that gives people a sense of how long interest rates are going to be very low.
No, I think statement one or meeting one is pretty straightforward, but I think it's really once you get beyond that it gets pretty thorny.
Well, so that depends on how you're going to do it. I mean,
the success that you have. I mean, you know, there to some degree, if it gets to be 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 quarters or whatever, and you're not sort of getting to where you want to be, there's inflation or what, you know, whatever, there's likely some inflation. I mean, the communication around that, you are in somewhat uncharted territory. And I think the question of how you say to people, don't worry, we just need a little bit longer and we're going to get there. I mean, that's a gamble.
Well, it's, you know, so, I mean, I've said, and I believe, I mean, it's, you know, solve this in 2 minutes. It's not realistic that the Fed is not going to be able to get to a certain level of nominal GDP, simply for the fact that even if there was no real growth in the economy, you could simply inflate your way there. That as a determined central bank has failed to be able to generate inflation has never happened. Some people would argue, you know, that there's some question about, oh, if you're in a liquidity trap, can you generate inflation? But at least so far in the history of central banking, no one has ever tried to generate inflation and failed.
Yeah, and so, I don't think that's the concern. That's the concern. But I think, I mean, there are certain parameters realistically that you're operating with. Look, I guess what you're saying is that will never be a concern because, you know, 3 or 4 or 6 quarters out, even if we don't have real GDP growth, that inflation will pick up and will be, look, we've seen over the past year or so what has happened when the Federal Reserve has generated some inflation. There were negative consequences on the real GDP side. You know, consumer confidence certainly wasn't improved greatly by any of these measures. And, you know, I just wonder whether it's somewhat self-defeating, for example, to take the run-up in gas and food prices, you know, which is likely to be the most responsive to any future inflation, just given sort of resource constraints and the way that the world works today. You know, to see that sort of start to play out again, you know, after seeing what happened over the past 12 or 18 months, you know, it undermines growth to some degree. So I just worry that, you know, reinstating that kind of policy or putting those situations in place. And again, this is a situation the economy has to deal with one way or the other. But to try and maximize that, knowing what the impact is going to be, I think does raise questions about whether you sort of harm the real GDP versus inflation mix that you get by trying to get more of it more quickly, ultimately hurting real GDP and sort of requiring inflation to do more of the heavy lifting. Which I know you think doesn't matter or isn't a problem, but I would think that actually it does leave you in a worse situation, you know, 5 years hence than if, you know, than if it were doing less of or if that were less of the way that you were trying to close that gap.
Yeah, I don't know that you have any control over how much is real GDP and how much is inflation, right? So if we stimulate the economy, we could get more inflation, we could get more real growth. And I don't think that we have any levers to determine which is which. So it's not to the extent of – so the reason I'm less concerned about that is not because I say, well, you know, inflation, that's great. You know, if inflation happens, that's wonderful. It's because we don't have any ability to determine what part of growth is – or what part of growth resulting from monetary stimulus is inflation and what part of growth resulting from monetary stimulus is real. We don't have any control over that. What we do have control over is – how much sort of nominal demand there's, how much stuff that people try to buy given the price level. We can push on that. And then if more of it's real, more of it's real, if more of it's inflation, more of it's inflation. And what you're talking about are real resource constraints, right? So that there may not be enough oil, you know, in the world to satisfy, what consumer preferences would be if, you know, at this price level, the same thing for food. Right. And so in response to that, the price of oil, the price of gasoline, the price of food will go up. But that's a real thing about the world. That's not something that we're creating. That's just a fundamental problem. Right. It's not, you know, if you know, to put it in sort of more normal terms, economists hate to talk like this, but I think it'll be easy to make sense. There's just not enough oil to go around. Right. There's just not enough food to go around. And I mean, you can solve that problem by making people so poor that they can't drive and then don't attempt to buy oil, and so the price of gasoline is not bid up, or so poor that they can't eat meat, and therefore our demand for grain is lower, since, you know, since our primary grain goes to feed cattle and other meat sources. So that's one way to bring down the price of oil and food, which is essentially what happened during the Great Recession. So the price of oil collapsed, the price of food went down because people became so poor they couldn't buy any. And that's a way to keep that from happening. But if you grow the economy, then these things are going to happen because they're real. They're real restraints. And there's nothing that you can do with monetary policy to remove that constraint. The only thing that you'd be talking about was, well, let's depress the economy so that those constraints don't bind. You know,
keep people from eating, and then the food prices won't go up. I think it's just a recognition of some of the real-world parameters that are a problem in dealing with this theory, which is to say they exist. You know, they interfere with sort of the desirability of the outcome. And so, as you say, you can either sort of say, well, you know, we'll find a way to make adjustments based on sort of ideally much wealthier, you know, households, or we'll, you know, adjust to it based on much less wealthy households, being the implication from sort of not stimulating. I just wanted to, because this is getting pretty down the rabbit hole, but it is important, and I want to just make this point, which is, you know, my concerns weren't and aren't so much with, you know, doing something for the economy right now. You know, this isn't about trying to prove that the economy's great and fine and we can just leave it alone and you know, no worries. You know, it's more to say that, you know, to substitute the NGDP target to try and solve these concerns, you know, may make a bad situation worse. And that if there's sort of serious discussion towards heading that way, should we sort of be seriously aware of, you know, the potential consequences here? Now, all of which is to say there are other potentially more preferable ways of trying to help an economy, i.e. fiscal policy, you know, i.e. directly creating jobs and, you know, spending directly and all of that kind of thing. So I know that the response here from economists is, maybe yourself included, is, look, you know, we can't make the perfect the enemy of the good. Nothing's ever going to happen on the fiscal side. So basically monetary policy, you know, does all the work. And my real concern here is that by not being vocal enough about what is the optimal outcome, and instead just sort of throwing the weight behind the Federal Reserve because we know it can act and is more likely to, that in fact we're doing a disservice to the broader discussion, which is to say this is not how we should be conducting policy at the moment, because in fact trying to sort of manipulate markets through prices and signals and just all the various different ways that monetary policy works in theory or just in actuality is one way of making an impact, but not necessarily the best way, and may have a lot of negative consequences. So, you know, where do you come down on the side of, you know, fiscal policy being actually the instrument here that would address these problems much more directly?
So I think, you know, and this is pretty standard New Keynesian. So fiscal policy is always inferior to monetary policy. You know, I mean, I guess maybe that's overstating it just a little bit.
I think that's overstating it a little bit. I think that's sort of like, that's sort of like the death of, I feel like that's only become true post 1970s.
Okay. That might be true, but, I'm not sure exactly what to say. I mean, so in the way we think about the economy and everything that we think is true, there's never a reason why you would want to do fiscal policy when monetary policy could work. Now there's a question, and I think this would be the argument of, you know, Paul Krugman and some other people, I won't force words into their mouth, but whether or not you can get monetary policy to work in certain situations, because what you essentially have to do is commit to things in the future that the Fed might not be able to commit to. So Krugman's famous term is a credible commitment to be irresponsible, which is basically to say that we are promising you right now that we will stimulate the economy until we get inflation and until we have high inflation, and that's a way that monetary policy can work. NGDP is kind of another way of doing that, only it's saying that if we got real growth, we'd be okay with that. But if not, we'll take inflation. So it's very, very similar to that. But even in all those models and all those thinking, it's hard to talk. It's hard to imagine a situation in which fiscal policy is the way that you would want to do this. I mean, it might be the way that you have to do it, but why do you think that?
I'm a little bit surprised to hear about that. I sort of, it would seem to me, and again, like, just based on some of the rhetoric I hear from other economists and people who I've talked to, you know, biased selection or otherwise, that it really actually is the other way around, which is to say, you know, monetary policy should be, in some way, you know, it depends on the business cycle. I mean, I do think there's some trouble with sort of saying all cycles are always the same and all situations are always the same and et cetera, but that it's really sort of you use fiscal policy, and when you can't, you turn to monetary policy. I don't feel entirely comfortable stating it that way, but I thought that the balance was at least more neutral. And I wonder if sort of we've become so overly reliant on using monetary policy here that sort of no one – I mean, so are you saying basically that if you were given the choice right now between sort of using fiscal policy and using monetary policy, you would absolutely go for the latter?
Yeah, if I thought it could work, yeah. I mean, there's no question about that. I mean, yes, is the short answer. The reason I think I'm gonna have to go in just a minute here because that was a special thing, but the reason I think that the economics community blew up in 2008 or, you know, when we first started the discussions over the stimulus, I guess really in 2009, was because if you sort of took what were the mainstream sort of models, the mainstream New Keynesian models, then they basically said you do everything with monetary policy until monetary policy potentially runs out of steam, and that's when interest rates get to zero or the overnight rate gets to zero, then it makes sense to use fiscal policy. So interest rates got to zero. Some people were like, okay, let's use fiscal policy. And some economists were like, what? I thought we were done with fiscal policy. I thought fiscal policy was like so 1960s, you know, why are we even talking about that? And so there was sort of a blow up about that because some people had basically thought that we had put fiscal policy to bed, and we were never going to do that again. But some of the models said that, you know, that this could be helpful when you've reached a zero lower bound, when interest rates have gotten lower to zero. So there's a big sort of like ruckus over that. But I don't know who, maybe Jamie Galbraith. I'm trying to think of who's the person who's saying that fiscal policy is fundamentally preferable to monetary policy.
Oh, sorry. Are you asking me who's saying that? No. I mean that now with the benefit of hindsight and just sort of considering more broadly the success or not success of the Great Moderation, et cetera, if there's not some kind of realization in this too, I am sort of reminded of some of the writing that Richard Koo has done about this. And I think he's an interesting contrast to Paul Krugman, where they both kind of diagnose a similar problem and point to two very different, you know, solutions here. Krugman pointing to monetary policy, Koo pointing to fiscal policy. And as you say, absolutely, fiscal policy had become sort of like this relic, right? It was like no one talked about that as being a solution. It was all, what can the Fed do? What can the Fed do? What can the Fed do? And I just wonder if we're coming kind of full circle and saying, well, wait a minute, it's not that fiscal policy isn't always and everywhere an undesirable thing. In fact, there are situations where it may be hugely desirable, situations when interest rates, for example, borrowing rates are extremely low, when there's sort of this sort of way it could help directly to spend and boost the economy, help productivity long term through infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that was a genuine question. I mean, I felt like fiscal policy was kind of making a comeback precisely because this question of how much more effective monetary policy can be, how effective it really has been in the past, was starting to get more serious attention.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that there's, you know, there's recognition of the zero lower bound that economists are split over whether or not, I mean, in theory, if you could promise to deliver inflation, the zero lower bound wouldn't be a problem. And the fact that interest rates are zero are a problem, because the way the Fed usually manipulates the economy is by raising and lowering interest rates. Or if you could credibly commit to keeping interest rates low for a long time, the zero lower bound wouldn't be a problem. That you can't do that brings in a role, I think, for fiscal policy. And when we meet fiscal policy, you know, I'll try to wrap up with this, and then we can discuss this other stuff later. Maybe we'll do a second edition. But
mercy on our poor listeners here, if that's the case.
Yeah, yeah. So when I say fiscal policy, right? You know, I'm talking about using government spending to stimulate the economy. It might be all sorts of reasons why the government wants to spend money. So, I mean, you might think that we have failing schools and we need to put some money in our schools, or we have horrible infrastructure and we need to rebuild that. And that's fine. And you would make like sort of a business case, a cost benefit analysis case about that. But then there's sort of the secondary argument that, look, right now the economy is in a recession, and what we can do is spend money, the federal government can spend money in an effort to alleviate the recession. And that's a little bit of a different argument. And my general case is that No, you would never want to do that if you could fix it with monetary policy, or it's not. I think it's fair to say. I mean, you know, I have to sit down and do the math here, but I think it's fair to say that you would never want to do that if you could fix the problem with monetary policy. So, I'll let you have the last word, and then we will have to go.
Now,
So.
I think that's a good place to leave it. Mull over this to me really actually seems like the central question right now, and I think it's become much more important, especially now with the consideration of various sort of more steps and more things that the Federal Reserve can do. And all of the focus on it is precisely to me what seems like I had thought it was just kind of this sort of, well, we know fiscal policy is a non-starter because of gridlock, so we're going to turn to the Fed. And I'm a little bit surprised to hear that no, we would prefer this to sort of be coming from the Fed. So I think that's the segue for round two.
Okay. All
I
right. Well,
enjoyed chatting.
yeah, it was great. It was great.
Scott Sumner, by the way, is coming in. We're doing an interview, and we'll be digging into this whole
Are you,
GDP thing even more.
is he doing the big interview?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay. Am I gonna do the big interview?
I don't know. This was a pretty big interview. You got longer hair than I could
But
get to.
I didn't get to go to New York.
Yeah, maybe someday. It probably won't be long
Okay.
at this rate.
All right. All right.
Thanks, Carl.
Talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye.